history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. You may not realize it. You probably have no idea what extraordinary things those seemingly ordinary neighbors of yours have done on our behalf. But we want to ask the right questions and take the time to listen to those stories that will amaze us. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn so much. We are educated, we're entertained. Often, we really do end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We have the privilege of visiting today with 92-year-old Dan Cano of Santa Maria, California. We're going to hear about his adventures in landing crafts in the Pacific during World War II, including his unexpected interaction with a legendary admiral. But let's start out with your childhood in Texas. Dan, tell us where you're from.
I grew up in Mercedes, Texas. Till I was 16, I went to CC camp and then turned 17 and then I joined the Navy.
Well, what about your childhood? And first of all, where is Mercedes, Texas? Most people probably can't point to that on a map.
Well, that's almost down as far south as you can go on the Mexican border, Rio Grande Valley. I grew up in the country. My dad worked a citrus orchard. I loved it out there because we'd go fishing, we'd go swimming. Always went looking for fruit that was left behind that were too high to get. And I'd be climbing up there, getting oranges, grapefruits, tangerines, whatever it was, you know. Then his boss offered me a job. He said, I want you to go to the dairy and get me 2.5 gallons of milk. And he owned the property where the dairy was at. And I'd walk over there. It must have been about 4 miles. Get up real early, walk over there, walk back, then run home, get something to eat, get my books, and take walk back to school. And ran. I ran like, oh, get out. Everywhere I went, I ran. So in school, I was on the track, and I played football. I lettered in football. But it was like a broomstick. If I didn't have a belt, my pants would fall off. We played football, but it was a battle because we'd played, some towns had a lot of Caucasians on the team. The Mexican people didn't go to school, so they were and didn't participate in sports. Our line in Mercedes was all Mexicans, and we went against those big old farm boys, their cousins calling us dirty Mexicans and bean bandits and whatever. The tackle was Kiko, and I was the end on the right side. And we had blocking assignments, you know. When I opened the holes, so we push him to the right and push him to the left. So when we got on the line and were set, Kiko would spit in the guy's face. And he come charging at you, and they penalize him. And that infuriated him. They block you and knock you down. They step on you. They elbow you, pull you, you know, punch you and whatever. And when we got him down, we did the same thing, you know. So it was a bloody mess.
Yeah, these were pre-face mask days. You guys probably had leather helmets, huh?
Nothing but a thin layer, about a quarter-inch leather. That's all it was.
Kind of like piloting a plywood boat, isn't it?
Yeah, the three-quarter-inch plyboard. But it was a real good life. All family around there. My great-grandparents, Antonio Cano, got a land grant from the King of Spain for his service when they first went to Mexico. He wound up in northern Mexico. They sent him over there to his grandfather, sent him over there to establish a fort and continue on north, you know, exploring. So for their services, they gave him a grant and right on the river. At that time, Texas belonged to Mexico. And we had family on the south side. We had family on the north side. Then when the territory became a territory, we wound up on the north side. My cousins, they wound up on the Mexican side.
So you're growing up in South Texas with that understanding. What kind of ambitions did you have? What were your dreams as a little boy of what you wanted to do or be when you grew up?
Well, when I worked for Mr. Shaw, cleaning the shop, cleaning chicken coop, taking the manure, piling it up out in a vacant place where they use it for fertilizer. I cleaned all around the working area. In the storage room, he subscribed to the first National Geographic magazine. So I'd go in there and I'd get lost going through the National Geographic. So at that time, there was a lot of exploration going on, a lot of territories and all over the place that have not been, nobody been in there, you know. Explorers were going in there. And that fantasized me with, at school, I was interested in geography. I wanted to see the world, you know. I was real curious about all these places. And then one day I came across this National Geographic of the Navy going on a world tour. It had a picture in front of the battleships plowing through the water. And as far as you could see, there were ships out there in the background. It had a caption, you know, Navy goes on a world tour. When they do that, they go on a world tour, we're just showing our might. Said, don't fool with me. Somewhere in the article, I read about join the Navy and see the world. So that fired me up. Said, I'm going to join the Navy and see the world. Then the war broke out, and everybody's leaving. And I was in the 10th grade, and all the older kids and friends, you know, they're all leaving. Homeroom teacher has just graduated and started teaching there at the high school. And one morning he walked in, he says, I'm leaving, I'm going in the Army. He was a real good teacher. First assignment in the morning was that you have to get up in front of the class and give a local event or a world event. He says, go to the newspapers, or if you hear something on the radio, you know, tell us about the article. At that time, depression, not everybody could buy a subscription or buy a paper. So my mom used to do laundry for this family. When it was done, I'd take the clothes over to her house. She'd pay me, and then I'd take money back home. She asked me, you like to read the paper? I said, yeah. He says, okay, I'll leave the paper out in the front porch, and you can pick it up in the morning when you go to school, because this is my way to school. So that's what I used to do, pick up the paper. And I had the source to make my current event. Then the other kids didn't have papers, you know. They used the paper, you know, and pick out the articles. The depression was hard, and everybody was poor. But nobody knew they were poor because we were all in the same boat. And as a kid, you know, nothing bothers you. The adults are the ones that worry where the next meal is going to come from. But us, we thought, you get a job, you get paid. There was no work. People were just wandering around. In the classroom, all these people were migrating. We'd walk into the classroom, and then the teacher called Roe, and he says, oh, we have Jane here. She just moved into town, and you're going to be in our class. The following day, Jane was gone, but Jim was there. Every day we had a new kid or two kids. With the people migrating, they went to school one day and then they didn't find anything. They just kept on moving.
You mentioned when the war started and guys started signing up, and even your teacher is gone after a while. But do you remember how you heard about what happened December 7th? Did you hear that on the radio? Did you hear about it at school? How did you find out?
We had gone to Mass. And the Mass was over, and we were going back, and then we'd hear, the people had their radios real loud. They're out talking to each other, you know, neighbors talking and everything. Then we went down to, it was a Mexican town. The whites had their town, we had our town. It was just like we had one big grocery store. There was a superstore. They had everything there. And they had a pharmacy. They had a fountain. We had a theater, restaurants, and barbers, and everything. And then you just go across this track, and there was the Caucasians lived there, and they had their businesses. But we went back and forth. But on the Caucasian side, there was a lot of Mexican people lived there. But you wouldn't find very many white people in Mexican town.
But so on December 7th, you went to Mexican town, and then you guys are talking about this. And how did you digest that news? Was it something that you understood right away, or did it take a while for that to sink in?
Well, following the news on the current events, we were covering that, you know, everything was about the war in Europe and what was taking place. So we were well aware of it and knew that they're trying to get the United States into the war. They were divided. They said it's their war, let them stay over there, because we learned their lesson in the First World War. But politics, we got involved, and then the Japanese got greedy and bombed us. It started the whole thing. and read a lot of articles and stuff that this was all manipulated. God only knows.
Well, whether it was or it wasn't, I'm sure you remember how it made you feel or what the sentiments were in Mercedes or wherever you went as far as the response that that engendered or the way people felt about their country being attacked. Do you remember kind of the atmosphere in the days and weeks that followed, what people were talking about or how you personally felt?
Well, we're talking about the attack. Everybody was worried, and especially the families with kids, you know, of age. They knew that they were going to have to go to war, and they didn't want them to go to war. But at school, all the kids, you know, we were all enthused, you know. We'd hear, so-and-so just left. He joined the Army, he joined the Navy, the Marines, Air Force, whatever. So, you know, you were excited. You wanted to go too, you know. You didn't want to be left alone there in town, you know, when we go there where the rest of the kids were going. And I already had been brainwashed with that picture of the Navy. And so if I go, I'm going to go to the Navy. And yeah, but what happens if they sink your ship out in the middle of the ocean? You're going to drown. So I wasn't thinking about that. I just wanted to see the world. But we were well aware of the situation. All this turmoil in Europe started in the late 20s and 30s, and then the depression, and the economy was down, and the people, you know, the families didn't want their sons to go to war. So that was the situation.
But you wanted to, even though you're only 16 years old, you wanted to sign up then or what?
Oh, yeah. I figured, you know, all we had to do is just walk in and they gave you a gun. But they said, no, you have to be 17 and then your parents have to sign. We stopped at the post office and talked to the recruiter every afternoon after school. So he knew us. He knew how old we were. Same story every day. He said, bring your mom and your dad. I talked to my mom, my dad at dinner, and we talk about it. So-and-so just left. I want to go in the Army. I want to go in the Navy. They said, no, no, no. So my cousin had joined the Triple C's, the Conservation Corps, and he came back from the CC camp after his 6 months. And that was set up to help the people during the Depression, the families. You would go in, and they pay you $30 a month. And then they would send your family $25, and they gave you $5 for incidentals. You had everything. So a hamburger was 10 cents, 5 cents, you find them.
And they had those CCC camps in a lot of places, but the one that you went to work at was in Colorado, is that right?
Colorado. Where we were at, they set up that camp so that we make roads for the mining that was going on. They were looking for uranium. At the time, we didn't know what uranium was or anything, but we'd build the roads for them to get to the mines, and the ones that they had found uranium, they were going in and bringing the material out. And this valley, Paradox Valley, is a big valley. It's just a big hole. We were there for about 4 months or so, and they pull us out, and they took us up to the north of Denver by the Wyoming border to the national park that was up there. And we cleaned up after the winter, cleaned up the roads, all the debris and rocks and stuff, you know. And I stayed there till I came home, put us on a train, and we returned home. And then I went back to the recruiter, said, okay, I'm 17. He said, bring your mom and your dad. Same old story. So finally convinced him. So already, you know, already going to the CC camps, you know, I can go in the Navy, same thing, you know. So finally my dad says, let him go. And then my mom says, it's going to be your fault. Something happens to him. I said, okay, whatever. So anyway, I joined November of 42, and then they put me on a train straight to San Diego to the Naval Base training. Went through the training there, and once I finished the boot camp, they sent me to the Strand, where there was a base there, just establishing it, where all the boats were there. And they were, they said, we're going to teach you how to steer a boat. So first time I got, you know, seen a landing craft and operating it. And then they told us, okay, take it in. There was an instructor with you. He'd go in with you. And he says, you're going too fast. Slow down or speed it up. I got to the point that I learned that you ride the wave like a surfer. You gauge your speed up and down till you stay on top of the wave, and then brings you right on in. No effort whatsoever. And then backing out's another thing. Your rudder has to be in the right position when you go out. Otherwise, if you broach your boat, do it sideways, the wave casts you and capsize you.
And so people understand, you're talking about these Higgins boats, LCVPs.
Yeah.
So it's not the biggest thing in the world.
No, well, we had the LCMs, the tank boats.
You worked with those too?
No, I was strictly the LCVP. I got assigned to that.
And we're going to hear what he did in those LCVPs when we come back. Find photos and a short video of Dan at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight.
Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free
because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.